Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Bentham, both pastors of Christ Church, Haywards Heath. Well, today we had the pleasure of speaking to Simon Ward. I'm not going to talk too much up front because we ran a bit long today, so instead of that, let's get straight in and I'll catch you on the other side.
My name's Graham Nichols.
And I'm Mark Bentham.
And my name is Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary. Welcome back to the podcast. Today we've got an exciting, a fun morning because we're going to be talking to Simon Ward. Say hello, Simon.
Hello there, everyone.
We're very happy to have Simon. Simon he's been, I guess, involved in the world of fashion for a lot of his career. I'm going to let him give us a little bit of a summary of what he's been doing. He's also involved in radio and music and all sorts of things. We're going to be talking to Simon about aesthetics and about fashion and that industry, because I have lots of questions about that. I don't know about Graham and Mark, but I've got a few, which is why I'm for the first time on a guest podcast. Can you believe it? It's very exciting.
Yeah.
But
we're letting you out, Josh. We're letting you out.
I know, it's very cool. But Simon, why don't you give us a kind of sketch of what your career has looked like, where you've worked, and then we'll start to drill down into some deep questions.
Yeah, I ended up, I suppose I ended up retiring from the fashion industry about 4 years ago. But for the last 10 plus years, I was chief operating officer of the British Fashion Council, which owns and runs London Fashion Week. Mm-hmm. So I ran London Fashion Week, which is one of the world's major, it's one of the world's major events, let alone fashion events.
Yeah.
And so that was, I ran that for about 30 plus years. And my particular role as chief operating officer was not to worry so much about hemlines and all the marketing and all the sales and that side of it and how good people looked, but to actually make sure that it happened. So I looked after the logistics of everything to do with it. I looked after all the talent schemes where we discovered new designers, our links with colleges, you know, the future, looking after the money, all the sponsors, all the people, all that side. So if anyone says to me, well, isn't fashion a little bit frivolous? I say, well, that's a discussion item. But in terms of the role I did, I was making sure it happened and keeping people in work and making sure we were actually delivering something, which is what it said on the tin. So mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it was dull at all. It was actually a very interesting time. But how did I get into it? People said, you know, do I have a passion for fashion? How did I get into fashion? And actually, I always say that fashion found me, because when I was at school, I wanted to join the army because my dad was in the Navy, but that didn't work out. I never wanted to come to London. I never wanted to work in office, but I found myself, having failed my A-levels the first time round, scraping in to Goldsmiths College in London, and ended up working in Selfridges to pay the bills whilst I studied an opera singer, because I discovered that I could sing. So I spent about 10 years doing that. The opera singing didn't work out. Meantime, I'd refound my child time faith as a Christian, courtesy of my brother, who was always praying for me from a distance. And I took up that with a vengeance, and took on with my wife running the children's work, which was a big work with, you know, about 150 kids or so. Persuaded the church council they needed to employ a full-time worker to look after that. And that was before these things were the norm. And persuaded them after about 18 months, and they then appointed somebody else. So at that stage, I was thinking, well, how many failures can you fit into one life? And in the meantime, I'd been employed by the organisation that became the British Fashion Council. Mm-hmm. And my heart wasn't really in it. And, you know, the people there said, look, Simon, we've only really had half of you all these, you know, the last 10 years or so. Are we ever going to have all of you? At which point I decided that, you know, maybe this is what I should be doing. Maybe that actually was what God's plan for my life was. So, regrettably moved on from the other things I've been looking at. And, without having applied for a job in 30 years, I found myself ending up as chief operating officer. So I don't know what you think about what God's like, but as far as I'm concerned, he's not an old grey chap with a harp sitting on a cloud. He's a person with a huge sense of humour who slaps his thigh with laughter as we discover his plans unfolding for our lives.
And yeah, that's really interesting. And also, just to bring it up to date, you're now kind of presenting a show on Premiere, is that right?
Yeah, back in 2012, I started writing, which was sort of unexpected. Most of the last few years have been somewhat unexpected. It was something I knew I could always do, but I spent a day in, we were on a holiday in the northeast of England, and we'd never been there before with my wife. We spent a day on Holy Island, and in the evening we popped into the local shop. My wife wanted to buy a postcard to send home, and I was just flicking through the books on the shelf, and there was one all about Aidan, Bede and Cuthbert, who are the three saints who formed the monastic community there. And so I bought it, took it home, started reading it. And I'd wondered whether my day on Holy Island was going to be a special day. You know, you have these thoughts sometimes. It's a lovely sunny day, but nothing particularly special happened. But as I was reading this book when I got home, it transpired that these three saints, Aidan, Bede and Cuthbert, as they went round the northeast of England and into Scotland in the 4th century, they were healing the sick, preaching the gospel, raising the dead, as one does, but to encourage each other on the way, because clearly they had to walk and spend a lot of time on foot, they used to recite the Psalms to one another, all 150 from memory. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. And I thought, well, I'm never going to learn that many, but why don't I take a tithe? That's a good biblical principle. So I set myself 3 months to memorize 15 Psalms, miraculously achieved it on my bike, because I used to cycle up the A24, which goes over the Northern Line into central London from where I live. It's about a 50-minute journey. And I used to have a little piece of paper in my back pocket on which I got, you know, that day's or that week's Psalm. And every time I used to get to a traffic light, I used to whip it out the back of my lycra, have a quick flick down, put it back, and off I went again, reciting these verses as I was going. As you might imagine, other cyclists and various other people stared at me in astonishment. One, because you look a bit odd in some lycra on a bike in the middle of London. But secondly, who is this lunatic, some ancient prophet or something, reciting biblical verses? And as you write things, you think about them, don't you? And I start chatting to people. And I said, well, that's really interesting. That's really insightful. And so I said, why don't you jot a few of these things down? And cut a long story short, you know, I produced a whole sort of series of these thoughts. Someone suggested I put them in front of a publisher, which I did. They said, look, that's really interesting. And they were published as a book called Riding the Tide, which is 15 Psalms. And of course, again, as one does, as I was a musician, I set them to music, every word of the Psalms, because normally everyone's familiar with the nice bits, the pretty bits of the Psalms, because, you know, we have them in a lot of our worship songs, but that's not the whole psalm, and that really doesn't reflect life. And so I thought it was a useful exercise for myself, if nobody else, to see just how they all came together musically. That really helps you to understand, you know, what the psalmist was up to. And I look at the psalms not just as the Bible's hymn book and prayer book, which of course they are, but they're also blogs and journals of how, you know, guys back in those days, 3,000 years ago, used to engage with life, engage with each other, and most importantly, how they engage with God. And I think we can learn a lot from that. And from that, I started writing other things. And when I was retiring from the world of fashion, I wrote a book called The Character of Fashion, which asked the question, if God was boss, how would he run this industry? And I did have plans about doing a whole series of those, looking at other industries as well. But I got in touch with the guys at Premier Radio to say, look, you know, would you be interested in covering this? Because I had mad ideas about taking it round the cathedrals of the country as a roadshow, because fashion is a very accessible thing, particularly for women. And to be looking at, you know, the whole world of fashion, where God fits in, seemed to be something that would be quite interesting. Mm-hmm. A number of cathedrals I approached were interested. Premier were interested. At the end of the day, I'm glad so that didn't work out, because it would have been a nightmare. I could put on big events, but I think working with cathedrals, doing things like that, was probably a step too far. But Premier said, look, this is really interesting. Yeah, will you do a series of programmes for us? We've got a big female listenership. And fashion's not really something we've ever covered. I think a lot of people are quite suspicious of it. So I put together a radio series for them called The Heart of Fashion. And they gave me a little bit of radio training just so I understood it, even though they were going to have one of their normal presenters actually present the show. But after the first training session with about half a dozen other people, they took one look at me and said, well, you're a natural at this. And so I ended up presenting it myself. And, you know, when the first few episodes had gone out and they're getting good responses, they said, well, look, the person who's been presenting the Worship at Home show every Sunday morning, which is our biggest live show on Premier, they sadly died earlier that year. And this was a couple of years back. Would you be interested to cover it for a month, see what it goes like? I said, well, you're not talking about really about 4 weeks, are you? The previous two people between them been doing it for nearly 20 years. So anyway, top and bottom is, I've signed a 3-year contract to present that. So I'm now one of Premier's radio presenters. And who knows what's around the corner?
That is a fascinating life story. Ours aren't quite as interesting, but they're all God stories anyway. But I think Josh had some specific questions about. There were so many things we could pull on, so many threads we could pull on in what you just said.
Yeah, very good. Maybe fashion if we reference narrow there, into very good the, fashion reference. Yeah.
Well, indeed. I thought about that as I said it. Actually, I thought how clever I am. Josh, why don't you ask a question about
just
fashion?
Going back to that kind of skepticism perhaps of the industry and of the idea of fashion. I think maybe it's fair to say that some Christians would have the assumption that having a passion for clothing or fashion is kind of in a way inextricably linked to pridefulness or materialism or even indulgence. And so how would you answer an assumption like that?
It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but only a little bit. Yeah, I generally rattle through the Bible on the basis that in the beginning God created. So God's a creator God. He didn't draw up a business plan. One of the first things he introduced was the seasons. Well, how fashion is that? And if you look at variety, if you look, for example, I think there's 110,000 different species of tree. That's a bit overboard, isn't it? So the idea that, we should all traipse around in something that's, we'll wear a white T-shirt and that doesn't seem to me to reflect the riotous variety and colour and shape and form that God's introduced into his world. Look at the lilies of the field and so on and so forth. So the idea of season, of colour, of design and so on. And of course, when Adam and Eve got it wrong in the Garden of Eden and realised their nakedness, they looked round and grabbed for the first thing they could find and hung a couple of fig leaves around themselves. I could just imagine God's face as he came round the corner and looked at them. I shouldn't think he burst out laughing. And said, nice try, guys, but I think we need something a little more intricate than that. And he was the first designer. He ran up some leather togs for them. I'm sure they look pretty good. If you look at, if you look in Exodus and the design for the apparel for the first priests, you'd think that would be something where fashion wouldn't get a look in. But there's a whole chapter which talks about the design, the construction, the fabrication, the meaning, the symbolism behind those clothes. And if you want to step forward to the New Testament, the first Christian in Europe was a lady called Lydia, who was, she was in the fashion industry, a dealer in purple cloth. And all the way through the Bible, clothing is used as symbolism. Some of it negative, a lot of it positive. And so, and of course, what's the, when we talk about the bride coming down out of heaven, dressed as a beautiful bride, when Jesus returns and when this world is wrapped up and so on and so forth. So I think the idea that clothing, fashion, the way we look is sort of something that really God has no interest in is really not the case. I think he's very interested in.
So why do you think, you make a brilliant case for it. I totally agree with all those points. So I think there is utility in the clothing in, say, the Old Testament, but there's also beauty kind of for its own sake. So I think we just happen to be preaching through Exodus at the moment, and the tabernacle, there is symbolism in that it's symbolizing something, but some of it is just symbolizing beauty and glory and splendor. So kind of for its own sake, not just for a functional purpose, like, separating the people from the most holy place. It's doing more than that. It's actually making a statement about the beauty of God and so on. So totally agree with that. I suppose a sort of supplementary question, which you slightly hinted at, was, so what about the negative aspects, or what about the negative associations with the fashion industry and how you kind of connect that in your head because I guess there are, I don't know, that maybe that Christians are skeptical because they think, well, a lot of fashion is very sexualized, or a lot of people in the fashion industry are very immoral, and that kind of blurs their thinking about it perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd make the point, you know, it's not just relevant to fashion, it's relevant to virtually any area of human activity, you know, that fashion is a wonderful is a wonderful slave, but a dreadful... I'll say that again. Fashion is a wonderful servant, but a dreadful master. Yeah, it's not just fashion. If you look at the finance sector, hello. if you look at all sorts of, if you look at any creative sector. Creativity, I think, in particular, you look at the film world, the musical world, you know, Cliff Richard, bless him, you know, the devil has all the best tunes. You know, why should the devil have all the best tunes? I think there's something about creativity which, for me, flags up why fashion is important, that actually our God is a creator. He's got a creative heart. He loves beauty. And, of course, you know, his enemy, you know, Satan, loves distorting that, destroying that, abusing that, and so on. So I think anything that has the word creativity attached to it is probably a fairly prime target for the devil. But yeah, to come back to the detail, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there's more issues in the fashion industry than Vogue. Yeah, so for example, if you look at where, you know, where the fabrics come from, or where the fibres come from, cotton is by far and away the most used crop, as it were, and it uses so much water. That actually, you know, water's diverted from streams and rivers, which take livelihoods away from local populations. And there's a whole environmental issue there. If you look at the dyeing process, because everything obviously needs to be dyed before it then gets woven into fabric. And, you know, way back, you know, the rivers in China used to run the season's colour because the untreated dye stuff's coming out of the factories there just went straight into the rivers, which, of course, killed off all the fish. So not only do all the local people not have any water, they don't have any food to eat either. If you look in India, where they tan leather there, they use arsenic in the tanning. And surprise, surprise, a lot of the local people started going down with cancers and things. So there's an awful lot at what I'd call the bottom end of the chain, where, you know, fashion is responsible for some pretty bad stuff. And if you look then at the people who manufacture the clothes, yeah, the amount they get paid, the conditions in which they work, you know, really is not good at all. And yeah, and we're partially responsible for that, because, you know, one of the, yeah, fashion in particular, oh, I got a great bargain. We all seem to think we should have a bargain in the fashion world. Yeah, you wouldn't talk about having a bargain when you bought yourself a car or a washing machine, would you? And yet, you know, we all want bargains, and that's only achieved by, you know, working conditions that aren't invested in by people that aren't paid properly. The classic scenario was, you know, the disaster in Bangladesh in 2013 at Rana Plaza, where on, was it a Wednesday afternoon, whichever day it was, there was a big crack appeared in this multi-story building, and everyone was sent home whilst they inspected it. And, you know, they were told, you know, don't come back until we know the outcome of this this investigation. So all the retailers, the offices and the shops on the ground floor or so, you know, they went off and didn't come back. But on the next morning, because the people in the upper floors was a large garment production factory, because they had deadlines for Western high street retailers, they all sent them in so they could meet their deadlines. The building collapsed, 1,000 people died. And, you know, that sits firmly at the foot of the fashion industry. So, yeah, and, you know, if you look at the amount of clothing that's bought, you know, huge amounts of clothing, half of which is never even worn. And, the whole sort of fashion cycle, certainly on the high street, is driven by, you know, more and more ranges coming into the shops, you know, almost on a sort of fortnightly basis or so, just so we can have more and more and more and more clothes we don't want at cheaper and cheaper and cheaper prices, which means the people who are making it don't get paid. I mean, it's a vicious circle. And but I am glad to say, before you ask the question, that there's an increasing number of people, not just within the more corporate world, but individually, who are standing up now and say, you know, enough is enough from that. You know, fashion, you know, has a huge opportunity to be a force for good in the world, and it really needs to take responsibility for that. It employs millions of people around the world, billions of people around the world, and it's something we all need. Therefore, we need to take responsibility for it.
I'm just hearing all of that, Simon. It was just striking to me, and just trying to think through as a believer, how am I to connect these things up? So how, because I can see the creative side, the beauty that the fashion side brings. You have obviously the bottom end, as you phrased it. Just how am I, as a everyday ordinary believer, trying to put all of this into to think, what does it mean for me as a believer to be thinking about the creativity, the beauty, the fashion side? How do I kind of connect that with my everyday life as a believer seeking to live out for Christ every day? And just kind of thinking of those other verses which talk about inward beauty more important than outward beauty. What would you say into that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the two are mutually exclusive in the sense that to develop an inner beauty, which is obviously the more important beauty, if I can put it that way, that's something we should all do. And we do that by allowing the fruit of the Spirit to grow in us and so on. And that's a daily discipline which we should all pursue. And it's driven by love, love for God, love for our neighbour, love for ourselves. So, yeah, that's really important. But I don't think that means that outer beauty, therefore, is excluded by that. It shouldn't be prioritized above inner beauty, but I think it can, you know, there's no reason it should be, as I say, exclusive from that. And it's a tricky one because if your body isn't a beautiful body, does that mean you're excluded from the race? If you haven't got a pretty face, does that mean you can't look nice? And those are big questions. And I think the converse of that is that so many people I came across over the years who were blessed with beautiful faces, beautiful bodies and all the rest of it, they were so arrogant you really wanted to throw them out the door, sort of thing. And the way they dressed sort of just seemed to amplify and boast the blessing they'd been given in the fact that they look nice. And I think that's something where we need to look very carefully at that, is that just how do we try and not turn looking good from a clothing perspective into arrogance. And again, it comes back to fashion. It can be a dreadful master, but as long as you keep it as your servant. And I think part of that keeping it as a servant is just not just with the number of clothes you have or whether you pay the right amount for the clothes, but actually a sensitivity to those around you. So if you're going for supper with someone who's not overly fussed about these things and whatever, probably best not to dress in your finest Chanel dress or something like that, particularly if you're a bloke.
Mark showed up in his finest Chanel dress today. It was really made me feel uncomfortable.
I think there's also the and I sort of mentioned it just now, and I don't think I'm obsessed by it, but I suppose the sort of sexualization of clothing and the there's pressure on primary age children, particularly girls, to wear things that emphasize the sort of distinctives of being a woman rather than a man, even at that young age. So basically sexualized clothes. So I think that's another sort of parameter to think about. That doesn't mean to say you become, over fussy, but I think modesty is slightly underrated.
I don't think there is a single argument I can think of that would justify, what one could loosely call the sexualization of children. I think it's obscene. I think it's an insult to kids in their childhood. I could pile up comments against it. I think that's awful. I really do. And where the line stops, I guess it's at your best, puberty, when you become a woman, sort of stuff. And at that point, your body then takes on a more sort of a sexual look, if I can put it that way. But certainly pre that with kids, I think it's completely indefensible. And anyone who says otherwise, I would personally like to have a conversation with them, shall we say. Within adults,
I suppose it's this. Yeah, go on, carry on.
Yeah, within adults. It's a lot of, it's a question of judgment, it's a question of setting and so on. Skirt lengths, for example. I think most people would sort of have a sense as to where something starts to become provocative as opposed to just looks good. That doesn't mean it's got to be around your ankles, but clearly when a skirt's little more than a belt, I don't think you need to have a degree in aesthetics or morality to say, well, hold on, no. and from a wearing point of view, I think particularly young women, they need to be aware of the effect of what they're doing, and they should certainly never fall into a trap of imagining that just because this is what the advert says, therefore I can wear this and nobody will have the slightest problem with it. We need to take responsibility for the way we look and the context of where we look. And if you're going out with the girls, that's a very different environment to going down clubbing with some guys and things like that. A lot of it, as most things in life, does come down to personal responsibility. And that aside from a fashion point of view, should they be making these things? Well, that's a much bigger discussion about, you know, free will and, you know, human activity and so on and so forth. But so a lot of it does come down to, you know, just because we can do something doesn't mean we have to. And just because you can dress, because you're, you know, you're endowed with a, you know, a nice looking body, that doesn't mean you have to flaunt it. It means that actually, personally, you know, I think somebody's, you know, looks really good but is dressed in a slightly more modest way, actually looks a lot more beautiful to me than somebody's flaunting everything they possess.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Simon. I want to ask you, we've probably got about 3 or 4 minutes left, but I wanted to ask you a question about kind of people who might be looking to get into the fashion industry. I think there's kind of this idea that the fashion industry is clearly very competitive and in some sense looks mad from the outside. I just recently watched the McQueen documentary on Netflix, and my sister actually went to Central St. Martin's, so I have some insight into what that's like there. And you just get a sense of how kind of out there these designers are and how they're kind of pushed to be more and more extreme in order to be noticed, or in order to do something that looks on the outside to be very visionary or creative. What would you say to Christians who are thinking about getting into fashion? They'd like to be a designer or they'd like to work in fashion in some way, but they're nervous about getting into that world and where that might lead them, what kind of blind alleys they might have to go down mentally or creatively to be noticed in that world. What would your advice be to young people who are coming up who would like to get into the world of fashion?
Yeah, it's not for the faint-hearted, the fashion world. I mean, the nature of it, it's fast-moving, and it's a huge and competitive, therefore competitive industry, global industry and whatever. So, you know, there's nothing dainty about it. That said, you know, over recent years, I've come across not just Christians, but including Christians who really want to do something meaningful. So, for example, there's a great label called Beulah, who's based in London. It's a couple of young ladies who are part of the HTB church, and they went out to India years back on a short-term mission trip, and they were working with young women who'd been brought off human trafficking, off sex trade in Mumbai. And they were just so taken by the fact that these girls were almost certainly going to have to go back onto that trade because they had no alternative employment. And they got talking to one or two of the people who had manufacturing units there. And cut a long story short, they felt a real strong call from God to set up a label which worked with some of these women brought off sex trafficking in India to do a lot of the embroidery and so on and the dresses they're going to produce, and therefore provide meaningful alternative employment so they wouldn't have to go back to the sex trade. And it's just interesting that, you know, they've been, you know, a fairly successful label, and you know, when I was chatting with them a while back, they said, we don't measure our success on the basis of our turnover or our media profile. We measure it by the number of women whose lives we've transformed, not just those producing the clothes in India and elsewhere, but also the women wearing these clothes who actually feel they're contributing to something really meaningful. And the beautiful clothes they're wearing aren't just fancy clothes off a hanger. They're actually made by people whose lives have been transformed. And there's a sort of there's a glorious connection between the producer and the wearer in that. There's another woman who used to work as a buyer for one of the big internet chains, real fashion chains. And she felt a real call to go and work with some of the producers in West Africa and try to introduce ethical terms and conditions and so on and so forth, and then, you know, sell back to the place she used to work with. So trying to, you know, get into the inner workings of the fashion industry and introduce and take some difficult decisions as to who get paid, what at what point and so on, but, you know, re-engineer the supply chain to make sure that there was justice and compassion being applied. And there's a whole part of other examples of people who are trying to, either through setting up their own business or working with established businesses, trying to implement the principles of the kingdom of God, where people come before either profit or produce.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you, Simon. That's been, we'd love to keep talking, but we kind of we kind of have to wrap up now because we like to keep our podcast to kind of 30 minutes, but it's been so good to talk to you. Is there any place that people could go to find out more about you, or give us kind of the times of your radio show so people can come and listen to those?
Yeah, you'll find
titles of your books. Give us a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a website, simonwardlondon.com, where you'll find stuff about the books. You'll find all the podcasts I do on there. And you know, the book about fashion I wrote is called The Character of Fashion. And you can get that off Amazon, or you can buy it off my website. Mm-hmm. And then the radio show is on Premier Christian Radio, which is every Sunday morning between 10 and 1 o'clock. And that includes, you know, one of my favourite parts of it is the slot, which are generally between midday and 1 o'clock, when a lot of people are getting back from church, if they've been to church, which is called My Faith at Work, which explores you know, a whole wide range of people, from government ministers to high court judges, just down to people who, you know, are grappling with everyday life as a teacher, or they've just lost their partner to cancer, or whatever it is. So yeah, just insights into how their faith plays out in what they do day by day. So that's me.
Brilliant. Oh, thank you so much, Simon.
Thanks, Simon.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for spending some time with us.